Bolshevism, Jewish subhumanity. Translated from the Third Reich SS original Bolshevismus, Jüdisches Untermenschentum. This is an excerpt translated from the Schutzstaffel original Bolshevismus, Jüdisches Untermenschentum, which was originally published by the Reichsführer SS and the SS Main Office Education Office, and marked, quote, only for officers. Forward. The present work recognizes the Jew as the genuine carrier of Bolshevism. In a short overview, it is supposed to show the Jewish roots of Bolshevism and portray its devastating effects on the whole life of Russian man. Only when one remembers what world-encompassing and folk-decaying goals Jewish Bolshevism strives for can one measure the danger that the Soviet Union, as the visible expression of Jewish subhumanity, means for Europe and the world. Illustrations are intentionally omitted, for every SS man and policeman recognizes, from his own experiences, or from the pictorial reports of the weekly newsreels and publications, the type of the Jew Bolshevik and his, quote, works. Chapter 1. Russia up to the October Revolution. The Russian mixture of folks and races. The most diverse folks and races swept across Russia's wide regions through the millennia. The shapeless and formless mass of Alpine men of Slavic language, incapable of any state formation, received their first state order from the Vikings. Daring travelers of Nordic blood were the ones who created significant empires from the centers of Novgorod and Kiev. It almost seemed that the huge space in the east would be organized and led by Europe, but the Nordic blood soon trickled away. Storm from the east. From the east, the world of the steppe surged, Asia's nomadic world, against the Slavic folk mixture. It was nothing productive that Asia sent. The 200-year Tartar rule over Russia ate deep into the Slavic blood and completed a transformation of Alpine man. And so does a Slav, Johann Peisker, characterize the Russian. Quote, there is first the Slavic slave who has fallen below the animal, then the Nordic conqueror disciplined in body and spirit, and finally the wild son of the steppe, the Turco-Tartar, the beast. Each of us has something of these contradictory characters. Hence, we lack the inner balance, hence our fickleness, our indiscretion. The Byzantine Church. This disunity of the racial foundation was covered over by the rigid Byzantine Church, which apparently drew everything into its orbit. And as the Roman Church raised the claim to world domination, so did Russia's church also believe it could present a claim to world improvement. Slavic ability to suffer. Slavic ability to suffer, the destructive flame-up of the steppe portion in Russian blood and the orthodox sense of mission, form an essential prerequisite for the later breakthrough of Bolshevism in Russia. The structure of Russia is reflected in the tremendous social injustice that characterizes old Russia. Before the World War, over 80% of the Russian population were peasants. They were subordinated to a thin feudal ruling class, which had the unlimited possession of the people. This chasm was never overcome. It produced great tension between the mass of the folk and the ruling class, and a despotic bearing of the ruling class. Call toward the West. Certainly, there was no lack of attempts to absorb European culture, to turn Russia's face toward the West. But these attempts, again, remain episodes. The non-European racial elements were stronger, so that the spiritual Europeanization did not succeed. But where the bearers of the ruling class were inspired by Europe's spirit, the psychological indiscipline of Alpine man is again observed. The unlimited despotism swung around to a radical social guilt consciousness. Tolstoy. In political regard, however, a terrorism emerged that only knew destruction. The result is the terrorist, whose activity is summoned up in the slogan, revolt, murder, shoot. But new life seemed to develop in one very important sector of life in Russia. The Russian minister Stolypin, he was born in Dresden, tried to establish a Russian peasantry based on the European principle of private property. A class of peasants proud to own their own property was supposed to bear the future rejuvenation of the Russian agrarian state. But Stolypin did not have time for his plans to ripen. In 1912, he was shot dead by a Jew in a theater in Kiev. Shots against the strengthening peasantry. The shots against Stolypin immediately illuminate the situation. The Jew murdered the creator of a strong peasantry. With sure instinct, this rootless, destructive spirit of Jewry struck with the murder, the bulwark that offered the greatest resistance against any revolution, but most of all, against the Jewish claim to power. The shots against Stolypin show the Jewish wire puller who stands behind the revolutionary movements of pre-war Russia as well. But this assassination of Stolypin reveals even more. The Jew who fired was not only a terrorist, he simultaneously stood in the service of the Russian secret police, with the assignment to protect the Tsar. That was always the, quote, work of the Jews. He appears in the guise of the good citizen against the revolution, and at the same time destroys everything that could hinder the revolution. Even in pre-war Russia, Jewry played a leading role in the revolutionary movements. In regard to economics, he almost totally controlled the lumber trade, grain export, and money lending to Russian landowners. Among the peasant population, however, the Jew raged as owner of the village taverns and alcohol trader. The Tsar regime, which sometimes sternly intervened against the Jewish subversion, was supposed to be overthrown at any price. The Russian defeat in the World War of 1914 to 1918 opened the gates to the destructive forces. The Jews' hour had struck. With the October Revolution of 1917, Russia ceased to exist. Even today, we no longer speak of Russia. With complete right. The Red Wave of 1917 cast up all the elements of destruction, rootlessness, and Jewish poison that had accumulated in Russia. In addition, new bands of plunder-hungry Jews from all countries poured in, ready to gain a position of power here from which Judah's world domination was supposed to be achieved. Hence the new name as well, USSR, Union of Socialist Soviet Republics. Here there were no longer any folks, any Russia. Here there were just Soviet republics, onto which one new Soviet territory after another was supposed to be added, until the goal was achieved, the World Soviet Union. Chapter 2. The Jew, an Eternal Parasite and Destroyer. A large portion of the bourgeois world saw in Bolshevism a worldview which was at first unconditionally damned, but when it was later shown that the Bolshevik could also appear in tuxedo abroad, many were ready to accept him as a Russian fact. A skillful propaganda also helped to deceive the world. Work of the Eternal Jew. The mask is off. Behind it, visible to all, stands the Eternal Jew. Rightly, one thus does not view Bolshevism as a manifestation of the modern period, for it instead is the product of Jewish thought. It is as old as Jewry itself. From the Old Testament to the Talmud, from the, quote, financial geniuses of the kings and rulers, from the great revolutions of the world and the Communist Manifesto of Mordecai Marx to the newest creations of the Jewish race, a line runs to the Jews' single goal, the establishment of Jewish world domination. Only the methods and disguise change, which adapt to the various times and respective situation. What does the Old Testament say? You will rule over many folks, but none shall rule over you. And further, Yahweh, the Jew God, obviously knows about the industriousness of his, quote, chosen people, for he promises to give it great and fat cities, which it has not built, and houses full of goods, which it has not filled, and dug wells, which it has not dug, and vineyards and olive gardens, which it has not planted. Terror. It is completely clear that the productive folks, who are supposed to build all that, will not voluntarily leave the places of their work and effort, so that the Jew can come and live a splendid life. In such cases as well, the Jews follow the commands of their gruesome God. They murder, plunder, and burn down whatever opposes them. As parasite folk, the Jew emerges already in dark prehistory. Theft, swindle, robbery, and murder against non-Jews, and the contamination of the blood of other folks, is the work of the quote-unquote chosen people, a work which visibly rests on the blessing of their god, Yahweh. The Jew has never built anything. Destruction was always his work. Into the most prosperous cities, he came as haggler and trader. As soon as he had money and economic influence, he knew how to acquire power as well. He subverted from the inside out the host folk until it was ripe for a revolution, which was supposed to deliver power to him. The revolution is Judah's star, which has lit the darkness over Israel's heads, and will light even more. So judges the Jewish historian H. Graetz in his History of the Jews. Revolution at any price. Hence, revolution at any price. In Europe's states, it was first supposedly to enable democracy, and from this springboard, to then proceed to the Bolshevik dictatorship. Only in so-called democracy did the Jew find the opportunity, under the cloak of, quote, freedom of opinion, to infect economy, culture, and politics with Jewish thought. Here he can agitate the folk against each other, under the disguise of irresponsible parliamentarianism. The domination of the press enables him to direct, quote-unquote, public opinion. Any feeling of duty and consciousness of responsibility is labeled ridiculous. He whips up the lowest instincts of the dregs of the folks. He incites desire and agitates the masses' thirst for destruction under the pretense of a life of paradise. He directs the masses against the racially vulnerable groups of the folks and destroys all moral feeling. When the folk has then, through self-annihilation and civil war, been robbed of its leading strata, he crushes the leaderless folk masses through the most bloody terror and erects his Jewish dictatorship. Rule of the proletariat. Where is the rule of the proletariat that the Jew Mordecai has presented so much to the betrayed workers of the world? The worker has only changed the master. He has become the slave of purely Jewish exploitation. That is the great crime of Marx. He tore the worker from any folkish life foundation, degraded him to an international proletarian who supposedly only had his chains to lose and a world to gain. He took the soul from work and promised the proletarian the destruction of international capital. Thus, a Jew, who himself shuns nothing so much as honest work, wants to lead the workers to a more beautiful life. A Jew wants to lead the struggle against international capital, which lies in Jewish hands and is directed by Jews. The Jew against the Jew. Here, at the decisive point, he shows himself again as the great master of the lie. Editor's note here, that quote originally was uttered by Schopenhauer in his Journals Speaking of the Jews. Continuing. International capitalism itself is only one of the Jewish means to destroy national economies, to agitate the folks into wars, to achieve power. The names of the great international bank houses, the names of the stock market brokers, and the great industrial concerns show their bearers as members of the quote-unquote chosen people. The Jewish capitalist world press then also praises their brothers on the other side, the slaveholders of the USSR, as founders of the most modern state of the world. New Front for Judah. Marx only organized a new front for Judah when he wanted to create from the leaderless masses of the workers a core troop that was supposed to pave the way to domination for the Jew with armed force. In the dawning machine age, he preaches class hatred. In other words, the self-mutilation of a folk, not in order to alleviate the needs of the workers, but rather to present the chasm as necessary and inalterable. It had to become doubly fateful for a folk when the existing social chasm was compounded by the lack of a strong, racially uniform leadership stratum. So the Jews skillfully exploited the disunity in the blood of Russian man. Russia's unrestrained element and its Jewish parasites were the best soil from which the Bolshevik seed could sprout. Chapter 3. Jewish Heads and Jews in the Soviet Union. But who provided the money for the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia? Certainly only the people whose interests were served in this revolution. Merchants of Death. Above all others stands the American Jew Jacob Schiff, who brought together a whole circle of other Jews like Warburg, Guggenheim, Loeb, and Co., Kahn, Kuhn, etc., into the, quote, financial general staff of the Bolsheviks. On April 4, 1919, the Jewish Chronicle, the official organ of English Jewry, stated it was noteworthy that so many Jews were also Bolsheviks. The reason was supposedly that the ideals of Bolshevism were identical with many of the highest ideals of Jewry. The Jew Cohen summed it up on April 12, 1919 in the magazine The Communist, quote, "We can say without exaggeration that that great Bolshevik revolution was indeed fulfilled only with the help of the Jews. The Jews were the ones who led the Russian folk to the new dawn of the international. They are the ones who not only managed the affairs of the Soviets, and today still manage them, rather this leadership will in the future certainly lie in their hands as well. The red five-pointed star, once the symbol of Jewry and Zionism, is today the symbol of Bolshevism, the symbol that promises victory. The Jews had indeed won a great victory for themselves in Russia in 1917. The great destroyer Lenin, who allowed his Tartar blood portion to fully manifest itself, was already surrounded by Jews. Editor's note here, he was also partially Jewish himself, at least 25%. Continuing. Strategist Trotsky. Lenin's closest advisor was the Jew Bronstein Trotsky, who was later overthrown. This Jew became infamous when he had everyone who would not bow to his military dictatorship massacred. He considered himself a great strategist and attributed to himself the suppression of the counter-revolution led by generals loyal to the Tsar. But he neither made the plans for the struggle nor won any battle through his personal bravery. He sat, as the Jews are accustomed, behind the front, had Russian officers fight, later stood them against the wall, and so wished to harvest cheap glory. Devil Stalin. After Lenin's death, another non-Jew, but by his whole essence a Jew by choice, became the executor of Jewish plans, the terrorist and criminal Stalin. In short, his past looks like this. 1905 robbery of a money transport in Tiflis. Result? 700,000 rubles, 34 dead. Head of the Caucasus Bolsheviks, illegal propaganda activity. From 1908 to 1917, he is banished to Siberia 6 times, but could flee each time. He possesses a limitless hunger for power and lives out of wedlock with the daughter of the Jew Kaganovich. He finally destroys the Russian peasantry through his forced collectivization. Through persecution and murder, he eliminates all his opponents and knows how to remain in power to the present. His speeches are written by the Jew Kaganovich, or Kaganovich. When he is worried for himself, the blood of others must flow. One wave of murders follows the other. His lust for murders leads to a limitless fear for his own life. He has himself guarded by a number of GPU agents. It is a consequential rise from highwayman to the head of the Jewish Bolshevik Soviet state. And again, Jews. Stalin's right hand is the above-mentioned full-blooded Jew Kaganovich. He is the driving force behind the placement of Jews in the important posts. He has brought 4 of his brothers into the highest state offices. He masters the ruthless extermination of all those who believe that Russians actually belong in the leading positions. However, he has made the Russian creature Yeshow the head of the personnel department of the Central Committee, and Yeshow faithfully put into practice, the practice, the Jewish personnel policy of his boss and master, and placed numerous Jews in leading positions. Stalin's instrument to remain in power is the GPU. It has probably discarded its original name, Cheka, because it has become all too infamous abroad. Founded by the Polish sadist Dzerzhinsky, who primarily uses Jews as helpers and executioners, the Jews, Myszynski and Jagoda, were then its head. Organized mass murder. Jagoda came up with the idea to use the GPU's prisoners for state construction. When Leningrad was supposed to be connected to the Arctic Sea, hundreds of thousands of workers were used. Jagoda provided these workers. Arrests followed arrests, and soon 2.5 million so-called political criminals worked on the construction of the canal. During the 3-year construction period, hundreds of thousands of innocent people perished. Jagoda made the GPU a state within the state, but one day he became too powerful for Stalin and had to take the path that so many of his innocent victims had taken. His successor was the already mentioned Yeshow, who proceeded with an energy and passion his predecessors would have envied. He was the one who carried out the great purge in the army, to which officers of all branches fell victim. Whether Yeshow's successors in the leadership of the GPU were named Beria or whatever, all of them were Jews or Jew-subservient criminals. The Hungarian Jew Bela Kun was a worthy member of these Jewish subhumans. He is responsible for the atrocity in 1919 Hungary, financed the 1919 Munich communist crimes, and proved himself as the infamous mass butcher in the Crimea to Stalin, who found in him a useful helper for other shameful deeds. As Stalin's instrument of murder, the GPU, was dominated by Jews, so are also all the other spheres of public life in the Soviet paradise. 14 Jews sit in the Soviet cabinet. Molotov is married to a Jewess, whose family connections reach to New York high finance. Litvinov Finkelstein and Maisky are named as examples of Jewish emissaries abroad. The government wares economy is totally dominated by Jews. The People's Commissary for Armament Industry, formed in February 1939, is occupied by Hebrews in all 52 key positions. In the sphere of the People's Commissary for Light Industry, 58 Jews are directors of industrial works, 56 plant department heads, 32 senior engineers, and 18 union chairmen. All responsible functionaries for finance are Jews, and so it goes down into all the branches of banking in the Soviet Union. In the Soviet press, they have always had the say. Chief of the news concern, Lass, is naturally a Jew, I.S. Chavisin, and all the other leading posts are occupied accordingly, Izvestia and Pravda. The official organs of the Soviet government and the Communist Party are swarming with Jews. It is the same in the rest of the Soviet press. Soviet science is in its full breadth Jewish infected. In 1940 alone, 699 Jews were confirmed as university lecturers, 174 as scientific co-workers, 202 as professors. Art, in all its branches, is just as Jewized. Quote, invention of Bolshevism. The Jew Mordecai Marx hatched Marxism and put it into sparse principles. Jews put its bloodline constructions into practice in the Soviet Union and call that Bolshevism. Jews transformed the dictatorship of the proletariat into the dictatorship of Judah, without which the Bolshevik system cannot be understood. That occasionally Jews also fall victim to the ongoing show trials has incorrectly been interpreted as a sign of a growing insight. But it is only a power struggle within the Jewish clique itself and within the Bolshevik apparatus of bureaucrats. The Jewish clique around Stalin dominates with its cohorts a folk of 180 million. But how is it for the Russian worker, the Russian peasant, for whom the Bolshevik Revolution promised a radiant future? Chapter 4. Industrialization. Slogan, World Conflagration. The Jewish Bolshevik Revolution was won. The country was in an inconceivable condition of disorganization. In the Kremlin, Lenin waited for the world revolution. But the hope for the instigated revolts in the West remained unfulfilled. It gradually became clear to the Jewish rulers that world domination could only be achieved through a new world conflagration. Russia is an agrarian state. Although it already had a metal industry in its western portion, concentrated at a few points, it played an insignificant role compared to agriculture. That was supposed to change. The industries of the great economic powers in the West were supposed to be caught up with and surpassed. At the center of planning stood heavy industry. It was, above all, supposed to arm the Red Army for the coming war of world revolution. The entire economy of the Soviet Union served this one goal alone. 5-year plans. A hurried industrialization started. 5-year plans with production goals were set up. Industrial giants emerged. Record figures were proclaimed in statistics to the amazed world. And what was the reality? Quote, we all sit here together, and instead of dealing with the really sad actual conditions in our economy or making arrangements for their improvement, we occupy ourselves with lying to each other. The most shameful part is that we all know that everybody lies, that all of us hence know that we lie to each other. Albrecht, The Betrayed Socialism, page 189, henceforth quoted as Albrecht. This statement does not come from a journalist, rather a People's Commissar for Agriculture, as a member of the Control Commission, objectively relates the conditions. In the years 1928 and 1929, those violent men had increasingly gained influence, who had come to power in the provinces in the Revolutionary War. As Jewish mercenaries, they were unencumbered by serious expertise and recognized no personal responsibility. Gradually, they had come into the central positions of the Communist Party. They were the champions of all gigantic plans. Every resistance against these incompetents was declared sabotage. Huge expansions of plans set in. In arbitrary confusion, industrial works of the greatest magnitude were undertaken, even before the existence of a sufficient raw materials basis was proven. Vast quantities of construction material was uselessly wasted, because these plants could not be completed, since the alleged sources of raw materials never existed. Or gigantic energy plants were built in inaccessible, far-off regions, whose output of energy could not be put to use for years. Often, systematic work was inconceivable, because the skilled workers were simply lacking. Complicated machines were purchased in all the lands of the earth. When they arrived, they were immediately ruined by untrained workforces. Quote, half-finished industrial buildings, countless machine cemeteries, huge mountains of reject wares, countless complaints from the populace about delivered inferior industrial products. That is the final result, this economic chaos. Albrecht, page 198. This bureaucratic planned economy, together with the Bolshevik fantasies about the future, produced an untruthful effect manipulation. The figures of works were, quote, would-be figures. Today's shortcoming was supposed to be bridged over by the possibilities of tomorrow. The really achieved production figures also say nothing, for all the rejects are included in the numbers. Even in 1940, the reject production for the machinery works was put at over 2 billion rubles. No wonder, for the slogan suffocating any responsibility was, the state bears the economic risk. Everything belongs to the state. Everything is paid for by the state. Nothing is my property. I never engage in independent economic activity. The compulsion to fulfill the plan led to the factory director producing randomly. Whether the products were sold or could be used did not interest him. Also typical of the Soviet system is the blind worship of technology. Only what is big and massive, about which one can brag, is important. And one must nonetheless view this incurable chaos as in part a manifestation of transition, in part as typical of the industries that do not primarily work for armament. The rich natural resources, the undreamed possibilities offered by the huge undeveloped space, and the slave whip of the Jewish overseers have, despite everything, enabled an armament industry that produces tremendous quantities of arms of every kind. The millions of dead and the populace's hunger existence did not count. The whole USSR. Quote, the whole USSR, implied here, is nothing but a huge weapons factory at the cost of the living standard of the people, a weapons factory against Europe. Adolf Hitler, in his great speech of October 3, 1941. Editor's note, that would place this pamphlet sometime in, most likely, 1942, as the date of publication. Continuing. Shortcomings everywhere. One of the greatest shortcomings of the Soviet economy was that it totally lacked the type of industrious resident foreman who concerned himself with everything. Bolshevism had done everything to create a rootless mass without any bond. An atmosphere of distrust and suspicion was intentionally cultivated, which dominated everything. In such a climate, however, industriousness and eagerness do not thrive. Finally, foreign lands were supposed to help. Specialists came. For several years, foreign firms obtained permission to erect factories. Foreign firms, rather. But it was soon discovered that the foreign experts failed as soon as they were forced to maintain themselves as individuals against the mass activity. Quote, the uniform pace of the human mass in the Soviet operations simply does not allow the individual to swim against the current. Albrecht, page 220. The great sacrifices that Bolshevism demanded from the workers could never come to complete effect, because the burnout of this economic system again devours very large portions of the productive work achievement. For example, for years, one complains in the Soviet press about the numerically proven overload of rails, of the rails, rather. This overload is to a very substantial degree caused by so-called cross-transports, namely because the same wares that are transported from District A to District B are at the same time transported from District B to District A. According to the calculations of experts, roughly 50% of the transports on Soviet rails could be completely foregone. That includes, for example, coal transport across more than 1,000 to 4,000 kilometers, during which more coal is burned than transported. Bolshevik economy is an economy without responsibility toward the folk, without really creative forces. The assignment of the functionary replaces the responsibility of the entrepreneur. An infinite quantity of labor is wasted in this economy. But despite then inconceivable mismanagement, despite all the mountains of rejects, despite the many senseless facades, 2 decades of exploitation of the rich natural resources and the squeezing of the vast human resources, and rather with correct emphasis, and the squeezing of the vast human resources, have created an armaments industry that produced many thousands of planes, tens of thousands of tanks and guns, which fills the arsenals with weapons of every kind, from the gas shell to the dum-dum bullet. Chapter 5. The Worker in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union has been industrialized at a crazy tempo in the last 10 to 15 years, but this tempo has been purchased with the misery, with the tears, and the death of millions of people. Slogan of the social state. The worker is supposed to simultaneously create for himself, and beyond that for the entire populace of his, quote, proletarian fatherland, a joyous and happy life. Supposedly, the Soviet worker knows no need, no exploitation, for everything he produces is produced, quote, voluntarily. He is supposedly the beneficiary of his full work of production. The profit that, in capitalist lands, goes into the pockets of the entrepreneurs does not exist in the Soviet Union, one says. It is supposed to have been dissolved into higher and more just wages, and in a welfare system unmatched anywhere in the world. This is the phraseology of Bolshevik camouflage tactics. The awakening after the first intoxication with freedom was terrible. Even Lenin had to admit that the dictatorship of the proletariat, this is a quote, has brought misery and deprivation to the ruling class, such as is unknown in history. Starvation drives the people, wherever they may flee. Never has the working class suffered so as in the first years of its dictatorship. Lenin, Collected Works, Volume 18, page 128. But these realizations did not improve the situation of the worker, who, in the Moscow state of compulsion, was supposed to achieve the plans of the Jewish clique in the Kremlin under, quote, painful deprivations. Jewish deception. Jewish propaganda understood masterfully how to deceive the mass of workers. It awakened the idea that only a temporary exertion with renunciation of personal wishes was required in order to overcome all need. It created a barrier around the Soviet Union that the worker could not scale. They were lied to and told that the worker outside the Soviet Union had it much worse, that he waited for liberation through Bolshevism. Hatred was instilled against the allegedly anti-worker foreign world, and from this hatred and hope for better days, the worker was whipped up to ever greater exertion. Not he was the master as the so-called Constitution proclaimed, rather Jewry dictated his working conditions. The Stachenau or Stachenau system. Previously, one had portrayed record work as an infernal invention of the capitalists, only created in order to exploit the worker. After Bolshevism had consolidated its power through a brutal system of terror, it disregarded the interests of the workers and pitilessly exploited the workforce. One such means of incentive was the Stachenau system. In August 1935, one had the until then totally unknown miner Stachenau, or Stachenau, who possessed extraordinary physical strength, taken to a coal mine in the Donetsk base, after thorough preparation with drugs. Stachenau then, not doing any side work, achieved a record accomplishment such as had never before been registered. Instead of an average accomplishment of 7 tons of coal, on this record day, he allegedly achieved a record accomplishment of 109 tons. Later, he collapsed physically. Immediately, the Soviet propaganda apparatus went into gear, praised this record accomplishment as a very decisive event, and demanded that it be made the foundation of work in mining. Wages were reduced, and the work quota greatly increased. The workers also soon recognized the deception, and instead of the hoped-for increase of productivity, the planned figures were not even close to met. The same ruthlessness shows itself in terms of work protection. Probably no worker in the world must work without any safety features, on machines, or in the mines like the worker in the Soviet Union. So accidents are frequent. A French miner portrays the conditions in a mine as follows, quote, "During our visit, we openly admitted. We became afraid. The shaft ceilings are porous and ruptured. The woodwork is extremely bad. In our opinion, the danger was so great that we did not dare go to the demolition spot. I can guarantee that in France, not a single miner would work under such conditions." From Kleber Legay's A French Coal Miner with the Russians. Most crude exploitation methods. Originally, it was bragged to the world that the 7-hour workday was one of the greatest achievements of the Bolshevik dictatorship. But the Jews hold the reins tighter here. The worker must work 10 to 14 hours a day without receiving higher wages for overtime. Forced labor. The Soviet worker fully stands under the law of forced labor. If he loses his workplace for the most slight violation, he no longer gets food cards and must leave his residence. The, quote, famous asylums for the homeless, simple board huts, are then his refuge. Indeed, a small percentage earns something decent under the Stashenow system, but the number of these workers is extremely tiny compared to the great mass. According to Stalin's own figures, the monthly wage of the worker in the year 1938 averaged 287 rubles, which at best corresponds to the purchasing power of a German wage of 60 to 70 Reichsmark. But even in times of peace, the availability of wares was so small that even this small purchasing power could not be used. A pair of shoes equals 200 rubles. Stalin certainly did not underestimate the monthly wage. However, when a pair of leather shoes costs about 200 rubles and a suit of inferior quality 400 to 600 rubles, the average worker is eliminated as a buyer for such wares. He must cover his need in the government stores, which only deliver the basic life necessities on ration cards and at high prices, and those wares are mostly of the worst quality. But the worker has the unions as the representatives of his interest, however. Quote, "These unions are not at all in the position and do not consider it their task to somehow lighten the difficult work and hard life conditions of their members. They are totally indifferent to the welfare and problems of the worker." Albrecht, page 69. Informers. The Bolshevik rulers used them in order to fulfill the production tasks of the plants, since all positions in the unions are occupied with reliable people, who above all are closely watched by the GPU, nobody needs to worry that the real mood of the workers will reach the public through the unions. A union member does, however, have one right. In meetings, he can, without basis, denounce people who have somehow made themselves unpopular. No wonder, when under these conditions, nobody yearns for a leading position in the plant, when indeed a downright flight from leading positions of responsibility has set in, since any superior is lost after such a denunciation if he does not have powerful friends. Informants everywhere. The GPU also works close together with these unions. A precise file is kept on every member of the union. If somebody has a reason to keep silent about something in his past, perhaps because he was previously an entrepreneur, priest, or officer, then that gets out at some occasion, and it is noted in the file. During the great purges of the economy, which are conducted again and again at certain intervals, it is then easy to send these people as enemies of the state to the forced labor camps of the GPU. The Soviet unions are hence auxiliary organs for the GPU. For all the lands of the world, Bolshevism promotes the strike, the occupation of plants, and the terrorization of those willing to work as weapons of the proletariat's class struggle. Only, quote, "the use of such means of struggle within Soviet territory is never allowed to be considered." Albrecht, page 79. None of all the promises of the Jewish rulers has come about. The happy life is led by the bureaucrat, the Jew, at the cost of the worker. The Soviet worker is the lowest paid of all the workers of the world, and must live under the most miserable conditions. He has become, like the peasant, the slave of international Jewry, which has harnessed him to the wagon of the Jewish World Revolution. Chapter 6. The Path of the Russian Peasant. All the riches of this world empire belong to the folk, the soil above all, whatever it bears or holds, as well as all the fruits of work. That is what stands in constitution of the Soviet state. The reality, however, looks somewhat different. With his lying slogan, "All lands to the peasant," Lenin had in 1917 ignited peasant revolts throughout the countryside. The peasant in Russia, in his vast majority, had always been a land-hungry, poor wretch. Now he grabbed. Government lands and estate hands were taken into possession and divided up. Raped peasantry. Quote, "normal peasant goods were supposed to be spared from socialization. But what were, quote-unquote, normal peasant goods? One person considered 20 morgen, that is 12 to 18 acres, of fertile land, to already constitute a large holding, but not another person. Lenin used this ambiguity to achieve his purpose. It promoted confusion among the peasants. Suddenly, according to the size of the holding, in the village the distinction was made between small leasers and dwarf farmers, landless servants, and, quote, kulaks. Note that a kulak is a former large farmer destroyed by the collectivization, which left a broad field open for arbitrariness. Hatred and envy spread among the peasants. The lazy looked with envious eyes at the capable. Each took what he could take. It came to bloody fighting. So the order in the countryside was destroyed, in order to gain control over the peasant. For Lenin did not have the intention to create a strong small farmer. On the contrary, he saw, quote, in the domination of the small peasant economy, the greatest danger for the coming communist ideal. His slogan, all land to the peasant, was only supposed to keep the peasants quiet during the fighting against the white armies. For what would have come of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia if a strong, free peasantry had risen against Bolshevism and its Jewish helpers? Therefore, the struggle of the Jew, who has always and in essence been an opponent of any being settled, sought the destruction of the peasantry. Next to Lenin, Trotsky was a bitter enemy of the peasants. He knew that the safety of the supply of his later World Revolution armies would be in the hands of the peasants, just as had been the case with the Civil War troops. During the Civil War, the peasants had hidden their horses, cattle, and grain supplies in inaccessible forests. Furthermore, many fields were left uncultivated. The land began to feel hunger. Trotsky's, quote, liberation of the peasants. In 1918, Trotsky unleashed his armed bands against the village. They were supposed to get grain and, quote, secure for the city, meat and other foodstuffs. These methods were a complete success. Burning and murdering, the bands of scum swept across the land and even robbed the poorest peasant comrade of his last bread. And this is the report of a Russian peasant about such a forced collection. Quote, but then I clearly remember this July morning, the Bolshevik pest suddenly came and with it several killers. They broke into our village. A few Bolsheviks, former convicts, immediately formed a village council, and, with the help of Jewish scoundrels, in the shortest time cleaned out the farms and stalls. Nothing remained to us, not a horse, not a steer, not a pig, and not a single hen. They stole everything, even our beds and our few possessions. Three big strong fellows, who had resisted the Soviets during the pillaging of their farms, were murdered in a bestial manner. Quote, we will sell your goods in the interest of the state. You will get the money for it later, they howled at us mockingly. We never received a ruble for our hard-earned goods. The only thing they left us was a little grain that was allowed to remain on our fields. When night fell, we slept as beggars under one roof, which also no longer belonged to us. The village councilman only remained a few days. When the last cow, the last horse, and the last wagon, loaded high with furniture and clothing, left our village, he also disappeared. Hunger, hunger. Under this distress, the peasant resorted to the only means still remaining him. He only cultivated as much as he himself desperately needed. The field produce sank, and finally, hunger reigned over the countryside as well as in the city. Between 1920 and 1922, at least 5 million people died from starvation, according to Soviet figures. But the Jew did not only need the grain for nourishment, he wanted to arm and arm more, and so the grain was supposed to bring in currency. So the Soviet regime decided on a step that was diametrically opposed to one of the Bolshevik teachings, as well as the former policy. In 1921, it introduced the NEP, the, quote, new economic policy. Now Lenin wanted to, quote, satisfy the wishes of the peasants at any price. A tax on natural goods was introduced. What remained to the peasant after delivering this tax, he could freely sell, and grain production now immediately rose again. Quote, for 4 years, one left us in peace. So does a peasant tell our German soldiers about this period. Quote, in that period we started over again from the very beginning and did not let ourselves be gotten down. Gradually, prosperity returned to our village. We again had horses, chickens, cooks, and we had furniture again, if even it was primitive, which made our farms livable. The women laughed again, and we boys were again ready to have fun. Stalin. When Stalin came to power in 1924, he clearly saw the danger that a strong peasantry had to constitute for the Jewish state. He often brags that he is an Asian. And so he again started the fight of the nomad against the settler. Furthermore, Stalin had realized that a world revolution could only be achieved through a new world war, so it was necessary to build up industry to produce his weapons. At whose cost should this industrialization come, if not that of the peasant? Where should the workforce come from, if not from the land? Therefore, quote, elimination of the peasants. The rural so-called Great Collective was supposed to replace the, quote, backward peasant small-scale economy. The limited free trade allowed under the NEP was again abolished. After the expansion of the infamous GPU, the Jewish clique around Stalin felt strong enough to crush the expected resistance against this campaign of annihilation and to carry out the, quote, socialization of the peasants. Peasant without rights. The peasant was supposed to first lose his rights. Stalin did it through an election reform. The industrial worker got 5 votes. The peasant won. Thus, the, quote, numerically weaker city was guaranteed the same rights as the countryside. But any peasant who employed more than 2 strangers as workers was no longer a peasant, rather an exploiter, a kulak. He lost the right to vote. Stalin thus crushed the political influence of the peasantry, or the political influence the peasantry might have been able to win. For according to the opinion of the Soviet big shots, the peasants are, quote, the most dangerous class enemies. It does not hurt if some tens of millions of peasants are exterminated. Before the peasant, our mortal enemy, devours us, we must finish him off forever. Collectivization is our means to subjugate the peasant. We will not rest until the last peasant is either put into our collects or neutralized forever. Albrecht, page 248. The path into the collective was the peasant's path into slavery. The ideal, agricultural worker without land. Agriculture workers without land were certainly easy to bring into the collective. They came with the prospect of a carefree life and without the slightest chance to lose anything. But the capable peasant, and he had delivered the surpluses in the previous years, did not go there. They again left their fields uncultivated, and again since 1929, hunger came to the land. Stalin then resorted to the most severe means, quote, the elimination of the kulak as a class. He saw the only escape in the extermination of the kulaks. In 1930, he sent assault troops of the party into the countryside, and the number of state-owned properties increased. A peasant describes this service of the assault troops. Mass extermination. Quote, Jewish scoundrels and functionaries plundered our farms anew, and did not leave us one nail. Later, we were driven together on the village square. A Jew put up a list of everybody who had attended a higher school or been abroad. Hours later, gunshots revealed what had been done with the innocents. The Soviets were suspicious of anybody who possessed some intelligence. After days of hungry travel, where we resettled about 100 kilometers from our village, the area we were supposed to cultivate was a real desert. The residences they gave us were miserable clay caves. At the beginning, there was nothing, not even a board, in these miserable caves. The hole in which 11 people lived was 5 meters long by 4 meters wide. That is how we became collective peasants. Suffering from hunger and cold, these people, who had been degraded to slavery, made the land fertile. Even where the collective was established on land that had once come under peasants' plow, the peasants did not have it better. They no longer had any claim to the harvest from the yield of the soil. Aside from a tiny, few square meter lot of their own, they had totally become borders of the state, which treated them as it pleased, and above all, always tightened the hunger belt when it seemed appropriate. For their work, the peasants were paid by work days, whereby a work day is not the same as a day of work, because there are work days that do not qualify to be figured as a day of work. So the peasant only has about 195 work days per year. In Slupser Rayon, he is paid for that 300 grams of grain per work day, which is 120 kilograms per year. In addition, the peasant also receives payment in currency, which is, however, calculated differently based on harvest yield, province, and region. Its calculation is done centrally. The swindle by the heads of the organization is hence rampant. The peasant receives between 120 and 150 rubles. hence a sum that corresponds to the purchasing power of 12 to 15 Reichsmark. That is an entire year. Double swindle. But what does the government also do? It pays the peasant for the grain it takes from him, 1 ruble per 100 kilograms. Or rather, it's supposed to read 11 rubles per 100 kilograms. The same government, however, sells the backed bread to the same peasant for 0.9 to 1.2 rubles per kilogram. Here, the double swindle that is perpetrated against the peasant becomes apparent. In practice, the official Bolshevik takes from 120 million peasants in the countryside the yield of their work without payment, sells the bread back to the peasant at a tremendously inflated price, and the profit goes into the great account of the world revolution. But that is just one of the paths along which the peasant is driven into misery, rather. A large percentage of the peasants was simply declared kulaks and sent to gigantic labor camps in the undeveloped regions of the Soviet Union. From one village south of Smolensk, 68 out of 200 peasants were deported as kulaks. From another, 54 out of 112 peasants. Quote-unquote, deportations. The scope of these deportations is revealed by a dispute that broke out in 1930 between local authorities and the central administration of the transportation system. The local authorities accused the transportation leadership of sabotage because they did not get enough trains for the deportation of the kulaks. The central administration pointed out that 18,000 rail cars had been demanded in the year 1930 alone, but that nothing of that scope had been envisioned in the plan, and that they could not tie up all their rolling stock and throw off all their travel schedules. But what was the success of the collectivization? Into the most fertile regions of the Soviet Union came the specter of famine. The harvest had to be secured with the help of the Red Army. Any peasant who kept a mere handful of grain, or a handful more grain than allowed, was shot. How do tractors and agricultural machinery help, when neither sufficient trained workers were there, nor the necessary spare parts could be obtained? And even if enough plows, seed, tractors, and trained workers had been there, there would always still be the passive resistance of the dispossessed peasants. Again and again, it was a struggle to secure the harvest. This struggle was in 1934, quote, waged like a military offensive. The folk starved and stole in order to preserve life. The famine catastrophe of 1932 and 1933. About 6 million, people fell victim to the Great Famine in the winter of 1932 to 1933. In that same winter, the Soviet Union exported almost 2 million tons of grain. The Jews exported, even though that meant that even more peasants had to starve. The grain brought in currency. Currency brought machines and certain raw materials for heavy industry. Heavy industry delivered weapons for the future global Soviet Union. Let us presume, said the representative of the American communists, Sklar, that another 6 million people had died of hunger. What is that supposed to mean? It is just the price of communism. Raw material or world revolution? For the Jew, the peasants are the raw material of the world revolution, nothing more. Since they were, as peasantry, a danger for the Jew, he exterminated millions of them. Any peasant feeling was broken in the ones who remained. So did the Jew mold the empty model of Soviet mass man, who knows nothing of his own, no joy of creation, no responsibility. With the extermination of the leadership and intelligence, the Jew created the mass man, the type of Soviet man. Chapter 7. The Soviet Family, Destruction of the Family. Workers and peasants were squeezed as empty components into the gears of the Soviet state machinery. The Jewish hatred against everything that grows organically also destroys the cell of any healthy state, the family. The Jew's aversion to all emotions that spiritually elevate man and bind him inwardly must by nature undermine family life, if the Bolshevik state is supposed to survive. The Jew had clearly realized that the revolution, this is a quote, the revolution is powerless as long as the concept of family and family ties exist. Hence, seeing in marriage a bond of spiritual or moral kind was sharply fought as a bourgeois or capitalist prejudice. Unbridling the woman. In accordance with the Stalin Constitution of 1936, The woman was given the same rights as the man in all spheres of life. She was supposed to help fulfill the proletarian revolution. That means nothing other than that the woman was surrendered, unnerved, and adapted to the machine. Her own consciousness for moral values was slowly killed. The great ally of the Bolsheviks was the economic need, the small wage of the worker. Just in order to barely survive, the woman had to go into the factory, and since she had the same rights as the man, she could also perform heavy male labor. Quote, "If you go to a factory or a tractor works, go to a hall where machinery parts are processed at blast furnaces, and who do you see there? Robust workers? No. Women. Women, who are lightly dressed with bare arms and legs, are at work at the blast furnaces. And if you express your amazement to them, then one tells you, that is the great conquest of the woman, that she has won the right to perform male labor." From Victor Borit's Leporadis Infernal. And what does the home of the woman look like after exhausting labor? Millions of dispossessed peasants had been sent into the cities in order to balance the lack of industrial workers. The cities were not up to this influx. The Soviet government did not think at all about caring for the housing of these people. Indeed, here and there some new living barracks were built, but they are far from sufficient. In the new industrial centers, miserable barracks are the home of the Soviet workers. According to Soviet figures, in Moscow, only 4 squares of living space per resident are available. In other cities, the conditions are even less favorable. Catastrophic living conditions. The tremendous shortage of living space has a consequence that often several families share one larger room. Frequently, 3 or 4 families must live and sleep in one room. A Spanish wall, a chalk line or window, blinds then separate the individual living spaces. That is the domestic environment of the Soviet family. Furthermore, due to overtime and plant assemblies, the eternal standing in lines for the simplest commodities, even in times of peace, and the deficient transportation conditions, the leisure time of the workers and the women is extremely limited, and so the domestic life of the worker family is totally undermined. Unrestrained sex life. With his so-called marriage laws and the law for freedom of abortion, the Jew put the axe to the roots of the family. Man and woman can change marriage partner whenever they want. An unprecedented promiscuity spread. The wantonness became a frivolous self-destruction. The desire became uninhibited to compensate oneself for everything that one had lost precisely through his freedom. The loyalty of conscience, responsibility, and duty had become obsolete capitalist concepts. When the birth rate then sank alarmingly, the Bolshevik rulers did indeed attempt, through modification of the laws, abortion was banned in 1936, to secure the offspring for military and political purposes. But the foundation of the folk had been ripped open, life unrooted. And that was also how it was intended to be. Child misery. The decades-long promoted dissolution of the family caused the number of abandoned and roaming children to increase so alarmingly that it became a danger to the country. Today, these hordes are the soldiers of the Soviets. But even the introduction of the death penalty for children over 12 years did not help much against this. But how can a state presume to educate children when it itself misuses children as informers against the parents? Triumphantly, Bukharin declared, quote, "The children strive with their weak little hands to undermine the family, the most conservative refuge of all the perversions of the old life order. They run away from their parents, spy on and denounce them, and force them to join the Communist Party. What ingenuity and gift of persuasion must these young beings summon up in order to accomplish all that?" So are the souls of the children poisoned, whether in the school, which has the precise task to undermine the influence of the parents, or elsewhere in public life, everything is aimed at this. Quote, "To educate the children to be social functionaries, who carry on the cause of Lenin-Stalin, and who will achieve the victory of communism in the whole world," said by Lenin's widow in 1938. The woman, next to the abandoned youth and the dispossessed peasant, has become the pitiful victim of the Bolshevik regime. She lives, without duty toward the family, apparently free. The natural energy field of her life rivers has been paralyzed. She has already long since lost the feeling for joy. The gun mall in the Bolshevik army is the final result of this development. deformation in vegetation, the no longer curable state of being delivered to the powers of destruction and annihilation. Chapter 8. Terror and Forced Labor. Terror. The all-dominating feature of Jewish Bolshevism is terror. Lenin was fully aware that the criminal system of Bolshevism could only keep power if it annihilated its opponents with the means of the most brutal terror. He demanded a Bolshevik institution whose sole task had to be to mortally strike the class enemy at any place and at any time, to, quote, bite into him lethally. Surely you don't think we can emerge as victors without the most gruesome terror. So did Lenin agitate the whipped-up mob to murder. In the period of the Civil War of 1917 to 1922, everything was annihilated. The Bolshevik says, quote, liquidated, that stood over the dregs of the people. For, again according to Lenin, the communist moral lies in the, quote, murdering and annihilating of all opponents. The number of the murdered is not the decisive thing. It cannot be even roughly approximated. Decisive, however, is that the terror did not cease for even one day, as long as the Jewish Bolshevik clique in the Kremlin has had power. Decisive is that the Jewish subhuman, even in the 20th century, could commit these monstrous crimes. Decisive is, finally, that a small, unscrupulous group of rulers could have the leadership stratum of an entire folk butchered in order to mold this folk into a will-less, animalistic, agitated, uniform mass, which is supposed to, beyond Europe, conquer the whole world for the Jew. When the first five-year plan was introduced in 1928, a huge wave of terror again started, to hood, across the land. This time, the peasantry was subjected to the special rage of Jewish lust for murder. The bullet, says Yagoda, chief of the GPU, is the very best means of struggle against the class enemy. Any peasant who owned a middle-sized or even larger-sized holding was liquidated. That means shot, without further investigation. Light Cavalry. The Jew Steingart had the privilege to think up a special baseness in the organization of the quote-unquote light cavalry. He formed groups of peasant children who, as young, quote, pioneers of socialism, are employed in agriculture. They have the task to watch and spy on the peasants. Any field theft, any holding back of supplies, and any anti-collective comment must be reported by these children to the GPU. The children are rewarded for the denunciation. Yes, Steingart even holds competitions among the children brigades for the highest number of denunciations. Izvestied, the government organ, was the first newspaper to publish photos of youths who had denounced their parents for theft of a collective property and delivered them to Jewish executioners. The worker is subject to the same terror if he does not allow himself to be used as a will-less exploitation object. The infamous murder cellars of the GPU, most gruesome torture and forced labor, are the means of the Bolsheviks to stay in power. No citizen of this land may have the feeling of being unobserved by another for even one hour of day or night. This constant fear of spies and GPU executioners paralyzes the people and makes them unable to revolt. So does each become the other's enemy. The most base denunciations advance the informant, until fate one day catches up with him as well. Forced labor. The greatest slavery, however, occurs in the forced labor camps of the Soviet Union. The construction of new armament centers and the extraction of new raw material deposits demand a massive utilization of workers, who usually must be resettled in the most distant and inhospitable areas of the Soviet Union. In the Kremlin, they solve this huge task very simply, and with the usual brutality. One turns these regions into penal camps. Political expellees and criminals were sent into the camps by the millions. Enduring a cold down to 50 degrees minus centigrade, these slaves of the 20th century have to live their miserable existence in tents. Slave Acquisition Post. In Moscow, there is a slave acquisition post, the so-called Gulag, whose head is simultaneously the chief of the GPU. In order to quickly deliver the slave material demanded by the camps, the GPU started its arrest waves. Through their flourishing business, this, quote, gulag, has grown into a downright paradise for swindlers, where the packs of Jews nested in there not only earn huge sums, They are also morally honored in Soviet society through presentation of special awards. The, quote, Gulag makes contracts with the state bank, from which it is paid for the mass utilization of the worker material. This human capture in the USSR is done under changing slogans. There was the government campaign for, quote, de-kulakization, annihilation of large and mid-sized farmers, in the years 1923 and 1926, whereby millions of peasants were sent into the primeval forests of Siberia and Karelia. Then there was the battle for the, quote, collectivization of the Soviet economy in 1926, whereby hundreds of thousands of so-called pests of the collective economies were arrested. Campaigns against pests of industry were also conducted. For that way, one acquired skilled workers and engineers for the new armaments centers. And so the human capture was carried out in the Red Slave Paradise with changing slogans and increasing success. Forest worker misery. But the life of these forced laborers in the great forests of northern Russia defies any description. People who had never seen a forest, who came from the southern Russian steppe regions, had to perform work that even a trained lumberman could have never done. Certainly, each banned man had a claim to certain food rations. But they could only be handed out if the demanded total work performance of the entire, quote, colony was met. And that was impossible. Hunger and exhaustion, illness and death, were the result of this deficient nourishment. In the middle of the most severe frost period, these unfortunates had to work in the forest without proper shoes and warm clothing. Medical care, medicine, and bandages did not exist. These forced laborers were intentionally annihilated. K. Albrecht writes about their housing, quote, in a row of low-earth caves, whose roofing consisted of branches and twigs, peasants from all of Russia were housed with their families. Although these earth holes serving as housing were located in the middle of the forest, so wood for heating was plentiful. They were unheated. These unfortunates sat or lied on the cold ground, totally broken by hunger and deprivations, cares and grief, apathetically staring in front of themselves. Many of them had not eaten a piece of bread for days, to say nothing of having brought something warm to their lips. Trembling from cold, the already half-starved children huddled against their mothers and fathers with tired, mournful gestures, begging me for bread. During my 4 war years at the front, I had certainly seen such misery, and I had seen much pitiful misery during the long years of my Soviet life. But this horror surpassed everything that a human brain can come up with in terms of maliciousness, baseness, and senseless cruelty. Albrecht, pages 158 and 162. Sex orgies of the youth. But Stalin was not satisfied with it. He made sure that even youths of both genders, aged 14 to 18, were sent to the forest labor camps. Year after year, larger numbers of these youths were sent into the forests in order to remove them from the influence of their parents and through allowance of, quote, the most free sexual behavior to win them for the Communist Party. Among these torments belongs also the blood terror of the guards and commandants. The GPU had decreed a reward, of 5 rubles for every escapee brought back alive, but 500 rubles worth of flour if dead. So one of the guards, after looking around to see if he was alone, called a forced laborer over during a work break, pressed a tea kettle into his hand, and ordered him to go to the creek 25 meters away and fetch water for him. Unsuspecting, the young forced laborer set off, and then the sentry grabbed his rifle and shot the unfortunate from behind. According to regulations, only forced laborers shot from the rear were recognized as, quote, escapees shot during an escape, unquote. Albrecht, page 181. Whether at the construction of the Arctic Sea Canal, or in forest regions, or in the new industrial centers, Stalin's executioners and his Jewish murders raged everywhere. Chapter 9. Final Observation. Bolshevism has ruled for 24 years. It sacrificed millions of people to the Moloch of the industrialization. It also sacrificed the material well-being of the whole folk to it. That is only one side, and indeed the more harmless side, of the USSR. It would have had to be the Jew ruling in Moscow to know that even the horrible misery of the mass of millions did not yet totally secure of his rule. He hence also destroyed all the prerequisites on which people can build. He waged the fight against God with fanaticism, and he promoted racial chaos. It is no coincidence that Jewry throughout the whole world helped to conceal the events in Russia. All these peaceable speeches and references to the, quote, interesting social experiment in Russia were only supposed to win time until it was possible to so deform a whole huge folk that one could dare to use this mighty mass in order to conquer the rest of the world. Aside from this deformation of the folk, certainly occurred a breeding in the negative sense, the development of a new, quote, leadership stratum from the great dregs of the intellectually gifted subhumanity of the Jewish ghettos and the Tartar Slavic bastards. We today recognize the effect of this contamination, in the soldiers of the Soviet Army, up to at least the 14-year-olds of the year 1917, hence those today 38 years old, all active soldiers and reservists are 100% trained and shaped by Bolshevism. Of the rest, only those have maintained themselves who have been a thousandfold tested by the Soviets. In fact, a totally Bolshevik armed force. And these millions had been, with all the means of mass psychology and brainwashing, with blinkers and proletarianization and the fanaticism of bestial drive, molded and turned into machines. Machines that were constructed for the attack, to crush, to kill, for blind annihilation. Machines that are far from any humanity, as dead iron and unfeeling mechanism. Machines for whom death only means the incapacitation of an individual part, which is quickly replaced. Machines that cannot be suddenly transformed into people again in order to be reasonable or to have compassion for the defenseless. And these machines have at their disposal other machines, planes, tanks, guns, and weapons of every kind. For 20 years, day after day, stood the overseer with the whip, the commissar with the revolver, the dictator with his executioner behind the peasants, workers, and engineers. Strategic canals and streets toward the west were built. For the joy of man, for his peace, hatred stood behind everything that stubbornly took place in the USSR. The hatred of the cast out, of the Jewish pariah. A blind, pitiless steel wave was supposed to sweep across Germany and Europe. Triumph of materialism, which set out to gain rule over the work. Triumph of Jewish rage, of destruction and arrogance. Fate wanted it otherwise. The German armies did not assemble one moment too early in order to meet the Jewish Bolshevik threat. The Reich has already often become Europe's savior against the floods of annihilation from the East. And, more than ever, Germany looks with trust and gratitude to the Führer, who, with the annihilation of the eternal Jewish enemy, crowns his work and gives it permanence. End of text.